So I'm going to talk about insight into dukkha, what gives rise to insight into dukkha, what that is, and how that gives rise to compassion, and how we need to allow suffering to open us and expand our heart. We need to be willing to go right down there into the depths with the nagas in order for the gold of compassion and faith and insight to arise. So we need to be able to turn towards the experience of our suffering, surrender to it, and give it wise attention, bring a clarity to it. So Sadhanandi talked about how insight is really basically learning from our experience. It's happening all the time, isn't it? This stuff of insight, the insubstantiality, the non-fixedness, constant change, the painfulness of some of our experience. It's happening, but we ignore it, or we look elsewhere, or we don't quite see it. We don't quite see it. So it's with clarity, with a calm, especially in meditation, we can access that. Calm to be able to really look at our experience and learn from it and allow it to free us. So what is it that then is seen and known about dukkha that frees us when we bring this wise attention to it? Two things. We just really get that this is how it is. It's not a mistake. It's not an aberration. It is how it is. We can't avoid the painful. And everyone feels it. It's a universal thing. We all feel it at times. First noble truth, there is suffering. And then suffering arises from craving aversion. So second noble truth. So what does that mean? So it means that suffering arises from resistance, because craving and aversion is resisting our experience, isn't it? As we looked at, it's a turning away from our experience. I don't want this, so I'm reaching out for that. I want this because I don't want this current, present experience that is painful. So it's a resisting, it's the opposite of turning towards. Resisting, and we feel that in the body. So this resistance of craving and aversion is always, always felt in the body. Where there's tightness, tightening, holding on, clenching in the body, there's always a resistance going on to our experience. And that resistance in the body always goes with tightening of the mind space, opposite of the sky-like mind. Two things co-arise. So when we really see that, it's we're seeing how the dukkha is primarily about the relationship with experience, the resistance to experience, rather than the experience itself. It's how we are relating to it. There's a little formula that I quite like, which is dukkha equals pain, painful experience, times resistance, multiplied by resistance. So painful experience, whether that's emotional, physical, painful thoughts, painful emotions, painful sensations in the body, pain, multiplied by our resistance. So you could have really intense physical pain, and in dependence on conditions, can be very challenging, as I'm sure some people who've worked with intense physical pain will know. But Maybe there's, at some times, there's a softening of the resistance. Less dukkha. Maybe even not very much dukkha, because there's an acceptance, a letting go around it. You could have a small amount of pain, and in dependence on conditions, your resistance to it is huge. Maybe, you know, it's just the icing on the cake, you're already feeling grumpy, and then just a tiny thing, and then you really resist it, and the dukkha is, the suffering is strong. So we resist in the body, holding on, and then we resist in our thoughts, don't we? So much of our proliferation, proliferating thinking is around resisting what is going on. And there are some little phrases which I think of as sort of archetypal sort of resistance to dukkha. There's if only. It wasn't meant to be like this, is another one, you know. And if only can so often go into blame. So blaming ourselves or blaming somebody else. It wasn't meant to be like this. If only I hadn't done that, or if only they hadn't done that, everything would have been okay. So in that, we can feel that basic refusal to be with, there is going to be suffering. And Vimalasara and Paramabandhu, in their book 8 Steps to Recovery, which is about mindfulness for working with addiction, there's a little sort of menu of ways of that we resist painful experience, which includes this blaming ourselves, blaming others, feeling sorry for ourselves, and distracting ourselves. So of course, that in itself, there's massive sub-menus of ways that we distract ourselves, ways that we move away from our experience. And of course, this is there in the precepts. I mean, mindfulness clear and radiant, obscured by intoxicants. But actually, we intoxicate ourselves in loads of ways. Intoxication is just one end of the spectrum, really. You know, using drugs, alcohol, just one end of the spectrum. So we all have our ways of moving away from our experience. I talked about cake, it's my favorite drug of choice. But another one can be all kinds of compulsive activity. Even helping sometimes. So we talk about how a near enemy of compassion is horrified anxiety. We can't bear the suffering, and so we go into a kind of state of anxiety, and then that often manifests in a compulsive activity, doesn't it? Compulsive, trying to fix it. We can't bear to just listen to someone. So then we go into trying to fix, convert, or heal in some way. And this is part of why the sacred uselessness is such an interesting and fruitful practice, because it can really reveal our unwillingness to just stay with experience. So we want to move into activity, subtle, because we don't want to be with just this, just now. So it can be really interesting to look at what is that subtle moving away, or not so subtle. And of course, this operates on all lots of different levels. There's the kind of, you know, strong states of aversion, of moving away, resisting. And then there's just really subtle states where we just not quite willing to be there with this moment. We're just wanting to pull away from it, and that can get really, really subtle and can be really interesting to watch in meditation. So all these different ways that we slide off our experience, and of course it's so understandable, It's not easy, is it? We all know this. But when we do manage to fully surrender, fully surrender, and find that sort of soft spot, that raw place, when we really go, place where we don't want to go, in the middle of that painfulness, then it opens the heart. And in that, there is less suffering. It might not be exactly comfortable, can be sort of excruciating, but there's also a kind of a satisfaction in being in that openness. So Pema Chodron, she's like a bit of a queen of turning towards, probably a lot of people are familiar with her books. She goes on and on about it in skillful ways. She talks about the same thing, that willingness to be vulnerable, to be raw. And she talks about how that when you go right down, 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 and you find that raw place, then she said it's like the seed of the bodhicitta. My mum died a bit over a year ago, and I had a, well, the day before she died was an amazing, amazing day. And she hadn't been able, she hadn't been able to speak for a few days, and she got it that she needed to say goodbye. And she, so it was me and my brother, my sister-in-law, and she just took some time to just turn her gaze to each of us and just send us love. And for quite a while, I just couldn't, after she died the following night, I just couldn't go there with that memory. It was just too raw. But when I could, you know, when I can, it's very beautiful. It's very, yeah. But it's so counter habit, isn't it? So Pema Chodron talks about that. It feels like it's sort of against our DNA almost. It's such a, he's had this habit, the habit of moving away. It's very, very strong. So there's the knowing that this is how it is, and the knowing of how suffering arises. And we have to look at that, we have to watch that, give it wise attention many times. So we see our resistance to experience and see how that hurts, dukkha arising, co-arising with craving and aversion. And we see how we let go of that resistance and there's a release of suffering. And we see that over and over and over, and then it goes in and we get it. An insight into dukkha. The conditionality of dukkha arises. And then the other bit is that we know it as dukkha. So we see the conditionality of it, and then we know it as dukkha. In other words, we know it as something universal. We know that other people feel this. And there's nothing like being right in painful experience for feeling compassion. So when we know other people feel this, compassion can arise. And obviously, whatever experience we're having, nobody will have exactly the same experience, because every single moment of experience is unique. But people will feel something like this. We can know that. And when we're right in it, it's so vivid for us. And so the compassion can be vivid in dependence on that. So when we know that other people feel this, it has two effects. So it can open us to compassion, but also it can lessen our own suffering, because part of that suffering is the sense of being on our own with our experience. It's somehow built in that, well, craving and aversion as we were talking about yesterday, craving and aversion arise with the illusion of separation. They arise with delusion. It's part of the whole package. And part of the way that manifests in suffering is this illusion that it's only me. It's only me. So often we feel something like that. It's me that has this terrible inner critic, worse than anybody else. Or it's me that's kind of has this kind of judging mind or this impatient mind or has such rubbish meditations or is particularly X, Y, Z. Or has this particular situation going on. Nobody else has had anything quite like that. So we separate ourselves and we want other people to understand it, but we're not knowing, we're not kind of knowing that actually everybody suffers. All the stuff, whether it's anything that we can experience at any time, you know, it's been felt before. Other people have it. So in meditation, this frustrating distraction or this anxiety or this vulnerability, depression, rage, embarrassment, it's common human experience. And we can do that right on the cushion. So we're going to do a guided meditation, bringing this in. But at any time, even with metta practice or any other practice, if we're stuck with something, we can bring in this reflection, we can let it be felt, whatever's going on, and then bring in that reflection. Other people feel this and see what effect that has. So I want to read a little bit from Vidyamala's book, Living Well with Pain and Illness, the Mindful Way to Free Yourself from Suffering. So I don't know, do many people know this book? Who knows this book? Great, quite a few people. Yeah, I think sometimes people can think that it's for people who have chronic pain, but actually we all suffer, so it's for all of us. One time when my back pain was particularly awful, I lay in bed and dropped into the pain, and with each breath, I softened my resistance to it. I felt I was dropping so far into my body and my life that I fell out of the bottom of me. I sensed a powerful connection with all the other people who were suffering in that moment. Children in African villages, women in childbirth, people who were dying. I didn't find connectedness by looking out of myself, but by engaging so deeply with my experience of pain that I emerged into something much stiller. The thought came to me, I'm not special. This is not a special experience. This is something that many people are having right now, and I can feel for those people because of what I'm experiencing. Instead of thinking, why me? Why am I the one with so much pain? The question became, why not me? Why should I not experience pain when it's part of the human condition? I don't think I could have felt that level of empathy without the pain I was experiencing. So I just want to say a bit about all of this in relation to metta practice and this retreat, so metta and insight retreat. So it's so easy to think that metta meditation is just about, it should be about experiencing lovely mental states. Just about experiencing love. We should be experiencing that. If we're not experiencing that, we're getting it wrong. But all sorts of experiences are going to arise when we do the practice. And all of those experiences can be part of the practice. So we're setting it up for all sorts of experiences to arise, aren't we? We are setting that up. So we're bringing ourselves in, inner critic, all of that's going to come up. we're bringing in a difficult person, aversion is going to be there. There's going to be the holding on in the body, there's going to be the resistance, it's going to be there for us to work with, for us to explore, for us to see the conditionality of that. And we bring in a neutral person, and so we're inviting in indifference, neutrality, and the tendency to get bored and drift off, independence on that. So all of it can be a springboard for understanding, compassion, and insight, and love in action. So Priscilla was saying this, but love is something we need to do. We do, and that's right. But actually, turning towards is a kind of doing. So turning towards, it's not really like it's a condition for metta. It kind of, it's inseparable from metta. It is metta. Love turns towards. That's what it does. So whatever's arising in our practice, we can practice love towards it. We can turn towards it. And we can see what happens when we do that. We can notice the conditionality. We can see when I resist, it hurts. When I resist, I can feel the craving, the aversion in the body, the holding on, the tightening in the mind tightening as the body tightens. I can watch that, and then I can watch it undoing. When I let go in the mind, I broaden out the mind into a sky-like space. If I can do that, I notice letting go in the body, I notice less suffering, I notice my perception of this person changing. So we're seeing Pratichasamuppada in the practice. We're seeing suffering being built, and we're seeing it dissolve. And we're learning from that experience. We're learning where freedom is. What are the conditions for freedom? And we're knowing this as an experience that's shared, universal, and compassion can come from that. So we looked a lot at the conditionality of metta, conditions that allow metta, and there are lots of them. And maybe it's a bit overwhelming. So we could boil it all down to, we could just choose to focus on one or two, and then all the others are interconnected anyway. One that we could go for is openness, opening. Because it actually covers loads of these. Relaxation is a kind of opening. Sensitivity is an opening. Turning towards, obviously, sky-like mind is an opening up of the mind. So an opening of the mind, an opening of the heart, undefended heart, and putting down the barriers, opening in the body. And those openings, they all go together. They co-arise, and we can watch that conditionality, how those ways of opening will co-arise. And then dukkha is the opposite, really. We could think of it as the opposite. So if metta arises in dependence on opening, dukkha arises in dependence on closing down, and we feel that in the body, and we feel that in the space of our awareness, and we feel that in the heart. And those, again, those all co-arise. All those closings, they co-arise. And Maitri Devi was talking about patience as a condition for metta. And in a way, you could think of patience as staying open. It's being willing to stay open, isn't it? So I really hope this is clear for everyone, how metta practice can be an insight practice. And just one more thing I wanted to say about metta practice. So it's so broad, it can be all these things, all this experience can arise. different experiences. Sometimes metta arises, but we don't notice it because we expect it to look a particular way. So we think we should feel, it should be boundless and huge, and we should feel great joy. But metta can manifest in lots of different ways. It doesn't have one expression. So if metta is a desire, an urge, an intention for there to be happiness, and that could be really quiet. It could just be very quiet, quite peaceful. Or it might be quite fierce, or it might be really quite joyful. But it's not as if the one is better than the other. It's just different. Sometimes when we're really with the sort of equanimity aspect of metta, when we're with the insight aspect of just knowing things as they are, knowing that there is going to be suffering and there's going to be joy at times, we're sort of knowing the breadth of the human condition, then it can be quite quiet. So there's a desire, may this person be happy. But it's not necessarily fireworks. It can be peaceful and quiet and even quite sober. Someone said this to me years ago, metta can be quite sober, and I was quite puzzled by that. But it can be. So I think that can be helpful. So when we're looking for the fireworks, we discount the quiet manifestation, metta.